This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hundreds of people join a funeral in the Canadian city of London to bid farewell to a Muslim family killed in a hate-motivated attack. Thousands of people hold rallies in France to voice their concerns about the rise of racist far-right groups. We'll have a report from Paris. And at least 18 people are killed and several more wounded in two artillery attacks on the northern Syrian town of Afrin. Everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Patrick Sajoka. Good to have you with us. Hundreds of people have joined a funeral in the Canadian city of London to bid their last respects to a Muslim family killed in a hate-motivated attack. Mourners paid tribute to the four victims as they gathered at the city's Islamic Center. Then they held a procession before laying the victims to rest. The ceremony was broadcast live on major Canadian networks. The family members were deliberately run over by a pickup driver last Sunday as they were out for a walk. The attack sparked outrage across Canada, with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau calling it a terrorist act. The incident was the worst against Canadian Muslims since 2017, when a gunman killed two worshippers at a mosque in Quebec. Now, in France, marches have been held against the rise of racist far-right and the defense of liberties. Protesters feared impunity of Islamophobic and racist militia and are asking the French government to take popular measures rather than copying far-right topics. Our correspondent has more from Paris.
Against the racist and Islamophobic far-right, in defense of public and individual liberties, that's the main slogan of 140 marches that took place all over France, organized by more than 100 organizations and associations. The protesters say there is an urgency to stop the rise of far-right militias and parties in France that act more and more openly and in full impunity.
It's the first time that we see people producing videos of death threats and using real bullets in a killing setup. We didn't realize the nature of the danger that's rising in our country. The day after the video, the President of the Republic's been slapped in the face. I think that now many people are aware of the gravity of the situation.
Earlier this year, thousands of militaries, amongst them dozens of generals, openly called for law and order against the danger of Islamization of the French society. Earlier this week, a known far-right activist posted a video where he steps with a knife and shoots with real bullets a puppet representing progressive activists and calling for the murder of journalists and the left leader Mélenchon. One day later, a far-right activist slapped President Macron in the face, shouting a royalist slogan. But instead of facing a danger of a fascist putsch, the French government was occupied in endless debates in Parliament and Senate about separatism targeting directly the Muslim community or in voting laws protecting the police.
The French government should be a barrier, but step by step it is becoming a bridge to the far right because the government is introducing in the public debate topics like migration and so-called separatism. There is clearly an authoritarian drift of the government, and all these issues pave the way for the far right.
The far right tries to introduce in France as a unique issue the Muslims and the insecurity. These are not the problems that we face. We face social and health problems. These are the real problems.
Protesters say that an authoritarian and racist drift in the French society is already taking place. This ideology is officially carried by the Marine Le Pen party. Instead of facing this danger, they say the French government is copying parts of the far-right program and is not making any concessions to the popular movement like the Yellow Vest protests. Presidential elections will take place in France in less than 1 year, and the odds of a racist and Islamophobic far-right leader taking the reins remain high. Christian Hunt, Paris.
Now, while the G7 summit is reaching its climax in Cornwall, a day of rage and action for Palestine has gone underway this Saturday to condemn world leaders for lack of action in protecting Palestinians from Israeli aggression. Protests took place up and down the UK, but in London, thousands mobilized outside Downing Street demanding change. Robert Carter was also there.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
International lawyer John Philpott believes that Western leaders who have committed crimes against Palestinian people should be brought to justice.
People have to understand that if you sell arms that are going to be used to kill people in an occupation, because it's an occupation, right? Gaza is a concentration camp. They have the right to shoot at those who occupy them and keep them in prison. But if people, and the U.S. is selling apparently better arms because their arms, the arms that Israel had were not as accurate. So those who sell the arms are liable. If I sell a gun to my neighbor who goes and robs a bank, I am accomplice to that crime. And that applies to the U.S. leaders. It probably applies to Britain. And Canada sells arms to Israel, and Britain does. And it's not the ICC. I wouldn't want to emphasize the zeal of the ICC, but they are liable. The leaders who committed the crimes must be held liable, both criminally and civilly. In the sense, they must repair the damages. They must provide reparation.
Thousands of Israelis have demonstrated outside Prime Minister Netanyahu's residence in Jerusalem Al-Quds. The event was held on the eve of a crucial vote in Parliament that could end the reign of the regime's longest-serving Prime Minister.
Anti-Netanyahu protesters at a state rallies on an almost weekly basis since last July to denounce his handling of COVID-19 and the economy. Netanyahu's sentiments have been deepened by his indictment while being in office. The prime minister is accused of accepting improper gifts and seeking to trade regulatory favors with media moguls in exchange for positive coverage. The Knesset will vote on the formation of a new cabinet on Sunday. If approved, Naftali Bennett would take over, leading an alliance of right-wing, left-wing, centrist, and Arab parties. Israeli forces have shot dead a Palestinian woman at a military checkpoint north of Jerusalem al-Quds. The forces alleged that the woman had planned to carry out a stabbing attack at Kalandia checkpoint. Her brother said that she died of her wounds after being left lying on the ground. Palestinian officials identified the victim as 27-year-old Ibtisam Kabna. She had been detained and sentenced to 18 months in prison by Israel in 2016. Meantime, the Islamic Jihad movement condemned the killing as the ugliest form of terrorism. The Gaza-based resistance movement also criticized the international community's silence on Israeli atrocities. This a day after Israeli forces shot dead a 15-year-old Palestinian near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The Israeli parliament is set to vote on a new coalition cabinet that could end the 12-year-long rule of Prime Minister Netanyahu. The Knesset vote will either see a fragile 8-party alliance to power or return Israel to a stalemate and possibly a 5th general election since 2019. The new coalition consists of parties ranging from the right-wing Yamina Party to Arab lawmakers. It's already selected centrist politician Yair Lapid and ultra-nationalist Naftali Bennett to serve as premier for 2 years each. After Netanyahu's failure to form a cabinet following an inconclusive March election, Lapid was tasked with forming a coalition. Netanyahu was already facing a host of corruption charges. Israelis have also held a number of rallies in recent weeks against Netanyahu over his handling of COVID-19 and the economy. A Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kendall, says the Palestinians shot dead over the past week in the occupied territories were killed in cold blood, and they pose no possible threat to Israeli forces.
Well, the Israeli police issued a statement saying that a Palestinian woman arrived at the Kalandia military checkpoint to the south of Ramallah near Jerusalem Al-Quds, and that she had a knife. The Israeli soldiers opened fire at her, shot her, and left her on the ground bleeding. They didn't even rescue her. We have to mention that many Palestinians were shot dead in cold blood, mainly at Israeli military checkpoints on mere suspicions. And later, it was discovered or revealed that none of those Palestinians who were killed on cold blood have posed any threat to the Israeli soldiers. If the Israelis were, their story was right, or their claims were right, then why they didn't post any videos for this Palestinian woman? However, a video posted online showed Ibtisam Ka'adni on the ground lying with Israeli soldiers around her. This is the story of the Israeli police.
At least 18 people have been killed and several more wounded in 2 artillery attacks on the northern Syrian town of Afrin. The first attack reportedly hit a residential area, and a second strike targeted a hospital shortly afterward. A local Turkish official cited hospital sources saying that a Kurdish YPG militants hit the building with a missile. The official said that Turkish artillery units shelled rural positions near the city of Ma'arat al-Numan in response. Turkey views the U.S.-backed YPG as a terrorist organization. In 2019, it launched a cross-border operation in neighboring Syria under a pretext of pushing YPG-affiliated forces from its borders. Now, in other news, Iran says there are still a lot of technical, legal, and political discussions that need to be made before attempts to revive the nuclear deal can bear any fruit. Iranian top nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi says that Tehran is seeking assurances that the U.S. won't withdraw from the deal again. Kamal Esky reports.
The head of Iran's delegation to nuclear talks in Vienna Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says there are still many technicalities that need to be resolved before a final agreement can be reached. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA have been engaged in talks to bring the US back into the deal and to ensure Iran's full compliance since April. Iran says it will only implement its nuclear commitments after it verifies the effective removal of all US sanctions, including additional ones imposed under former President Donald Trump, who withdrew from the deal in 2018. Iran is seeking assurances the US will not do so again.
They have to ensure the Islamic Republic of Iran that what happened in the past is not going to be repeated itself in the future. For that, we need lots of political, legal, and technical discussions. We continue these discussions and these talks as long as needed.
Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov said the differences of opinion between Iran and the US are not many, but they are of principle character. The main unresolved issue at this stage, he said, is how the agreement will be implemented, who will do what, and when. The EU, which acts as coordinator, said the sides are making progress, but that negotiations are intense on a number of remaining issues.
The EU will continue with the talks with all the participants to the JCPOA and separately with the United States to find ways to get very close to a final agreement in the coming days. Thank you.
Araghchi said he did not think the sides could come to a final conclusion in this round, adding that Iran would continue negotiations as long as necessary and until its key concerns were addressed. Homar Ezgi, Vienna.
Now, political commentator Scott Bennett believes that there is no guarantee that U.S. administrations would remain committed to the deals reached by their predecessors.
A presidential administration can change, moment by moment, day by day, any and all agreements and any and all treaties and such that are entered into. So there's really no firm reliance or absolute dependability on an American presidential administration and these promises. However, if I was advising the Iranians, I would say the best way to guarantee and ensure that the United States government and the presidential administration commits to and fulfills and honors all of the elements and promises of the JCPOA is to make it absolutely attractive and a deal that the American people themselves could not turn down. And that's really the target of all negotiation and diplomatic communications and public relations and persuasion operations should be towards the American people, not the government, not the military-industrial complex, not the Zionists in Congress or the Mossad-friendly puppets who have been extorted.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the merciful, the all-compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps, and seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The findings released by the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and Drug Policy Alliance, DPA, showed that 83% of Americans say the war on drugs has failed. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanis Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Poll shows 83% of Americans believe so-called war on drugs an abject failure. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. New polling released recently reveals that an overwhelming majority of Americans think the so-called war on drugs is a total failure, underscoring broad support for a new approach that puts public health over criminalization and a militarized response to the illegal narcotics trade that has lasted for decades in the U.S. The findings released by the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and Drug Policy Alliance, DPA, showed that 83% of Americans say the war on drugs has failed. That assessment is felt similarly across party lines. 83% of Democrats express that view, as did 85% of independents and 82% of Republicans. Nearly two-thirds of respondents, that is about 65%, said it's time to end the war on drugs. The poll also found that 66% of voters support getting rid of criminal penalties for drug possession and reinvesting drug enforcement resources into treatment and addiction services. Similar percentages were seen in support for eliminating mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes, that is 64%, and for commuting or reducing the sentences of people incarcerated for drugs, 61%. A further finding was that 63% think drug use should be addressed as a public health issue, compared to just 33% say it should be addressed as a criminal justice issue. The polling came just ahead of the 50th anniversary of President Richard Nixon's War on Drugs Declaration. On June 17, 1971, Nixon called drug abuse public enemy number one and said it must be met with an all-out offensive. Opponents of the approach say it's spared decades of widespread harms to people and communities both in the U.S. and worldwide. As a senator, Joe Biden promoted the war on drugs, but in his 2020 presidential campaign, sounded a different note, calling instead for a public health approach to substance abuse. In January, just ahead of his inauguration, a coalition of more than 200 drug policy, healthcare, and other community-based organizations called on Biden to end the war on drugs, telling the then-incoming administration that the time for urgent bold change is now. Odie Ofer, director of the ACLU's Justice Division, urged the president to make good on his campaign pledge in a statement pointing to the drug war's fueling of the incarceration crisis. Ofer said, on this 50th anniversary of the drug war, President Biden must take good on his campaign promises and take steps to begin dismantling the system of over-policing and mass incarceration that is endemic to the war on drugs. He added, today, drug possession continues to be the number one arrest in the United States, with more than 1.35 million arrests per year. Every 25 seconds, a person is arrested for possessing drugs for personal use, with black people disproportionately targeted by this over-policing. It's time to adopt a new approach that treats substance use as a public health issue rather than a criminal justice one, Ofer continued, adding, Biden, he said, can make headway in ending this harmful and racist war by commuting the sentences of people incarcerated in federal prison for drugs. According to DPA Executive Director Cassandra Frederick, the new poll shows a different reality, one where we treat people who use drugs with dignity and respect, and one where drugs are no longer an excuse for law enforcement to surveil, harass, assault, and even kill black, Latinx, and indigenous people is 100% possible. With the devastation of drug war plain to see, Frederick said, It should come as no surprise that Americans are ready for a drastically different approach. She said, we deserve to live in a world where the health and safety of our communities are paramount. And that means eliminating all the ways in which we are criminalized and building an alternative response to get the support and help we need, unquote.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Communique.
Syrians have taken to the polls and re-elected Bashar al-Assad as president of the Syrian Arab Republic for a fourth consecutive term. With an extraordinary turnout rate and landslide victory, the West has actively sought to undermine the election and the will of the Syrian people. So what does this victory mean for Syria's 10-year resistance against regime change and against imperialism? And what tactics have Western nations resorted to in order to discredit and sabotage Syria's presidential elections? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On May 26, 2021, Syrians took to the polls to vote in the second presidential elections since the start of the war on Syria in 2011. A month earlier, in April, 14 candidates had been approved to run by the People's Assembly. Bashar al-Assad, candidate of the Ba'ath Party, won in a landslide victory of 95.2%. The turnout was an astonishing 78.6%, which is very high under any circumstances, never mind for a country under siege. After the results of the elections were announced on May 27th, Syrians went out to celebrate, taking to the streets in droves. People all over Syria came out to celebrate with scenes of victory in Umayyad Square, in the country's capital, Damascus. Scores of people poured out onto the streets of the port city of Tartus on the Mediterranean Sea, with similar images popping out from all over the nation. With a turnout rate of 78.6%, this is quite a remarkable feat. In European elections, the turnout rate is usually somewhere between 50 and 60%. The turnout rate in the 2020 presidential elections in the US was around a record-breaking 67%. The head of the Syrian parliament, Hamoud Sabah, announced the results of the election with around 14 million Syrians who came out to vote, which, given the situation of so many Syrians displaced by the war and the country still in turmoil, is very impressive. Now, before a single vote was cast, Western nations were already attempting to undermine the Syrian presidential elections. Several of them outright rejected the results in advance and proceeded to call the elections undemocratic. They claimed that the elections were illegitimate because they allegedly left many Syrians excluded. Ironically, these very same countries themselves prevented Syrians living abroad from even voting in the first place. For example, in Canada and Germany, Syrians were prevented from casting ballots at the Syrian consulate. These very same countries who pretend to be liberal democracies then turn around and deny Syrians the right to participate in their own presidential elections and prevent them from exercising their right to vote, which is a pivotal part of any supposed democracy. This claim that Syrians were purposely excluded was not just repeated by Western countries, but also by the opposition and opposition figures, which is all the more ridiculous given that the opposition, they are the ones who boycotted the electoral process, refusing to participate. In the northern city of Idlib, which is home to thousands of foreign-backed terrorists, of course it is not possible to partake in the election. The same rings true for the areas controlled by the American occupation and Kurdish forces in the northeast regions of Hasake and Deir ez-Zor, where they are busy plundering Syria's oil, of course.
We're keeping the oil. We have the oil. The oil is secure. We left troops behind only for the oil.
Now, in the media, the reporting about the elections has been abysmal. We have witnessed a concerted campaign by the corporate mainstream media to smear Syrians and their elections and to openly lie about the will of the Syrian people. Not one mainstream outlet in the West has even had any Syrian officials on to comment about the election, only opposition figures. The media have also resorted to talking about the staged Duma gas attack of 2018. This alleged gas attack was used as a pretext by the United States, Britain, and France to illegally bomb Syria. It was subsequently proven that this gas attack never took place, a false flag operation designed to blame the Syrian government as the Syrian army made its final push to take back the surrounding areas of Ghouta in the Damascus countryside. We have seen through leaked documents published by WikiLeaks that this gas attack never happened. The very same inspectors sent by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, to investigate reported only trace quantities of chlorine, physical symptoms inconsistent with the gas attack, and ballistics showing the alleged gas canister to have been manually placed at the site. The inspectors concluded that given the lack of evidence, no gas attack had materialized and expressed concern after their findings had been removed. The OPCW's leadership doctored the reports of the fact-finding mission, removing key evidence in an attempt to cover up the truth and proceeding to smear its own scientists who blew the whistle. During this latest election in Syria, President Bashar al-Assad went to Duma to cast his ballot. The mainstream media used this photo op as an opportunity to revive the lies surrounding this staged gas attack and to attempt to smear the Syrian government and President al-Assad once more. Right now in Syria, many people are suffering due to the terrible economic situation and havoc brought on by sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union. Universally, in almost every article and television report on the topic of Syrian elections, the mainstream media talks of the economic turmoil that Syrians are living through, without ever mentioning that this suffering, the long bread lines, the wait of almost 2 days just for fuel, is a direct consequence of Western sanctions. The media talk about Syrians living in poverty to illustrate the people's purported dissatisfaction with al-Assad, giving the impression that it is the fault of the Syrian government. First of all, this has nothing to do with elections. Second, this is not only untrue, but more importantly, it is a whitewashing of Western crimes. Syrians are suffering and starving right now precisely because of the West's foreign policy and imperialism, yet this is rarely ever mentioned, if at all. If one wants a real example of propaganda, they need look no further than how the Western media reports on all matters related to Syria. It's frankly astonishing how anyone can make a report about the Syrian elections and not mention a simple basic truth that the majority of Syrians support Bashar al-Assad. If these so-called liberal democracies in Europe and North America care so much about democracy and the will of the people, why do they ignore this fact? It is incredible how not one report or article mentions this. The media call the elections a sham, but they talk about everything else without actually explaining why. They obfuscate and change the subject by mentioning the economic turmoil, but don't tell you that this is the fault of Western sanctions, and they try to make it sound like it's al-Assad's fault or the Syrian government is to blame. They talk about democracy, but don't tell you that the majority of Syrians support al-Assad, nor do they show any of the images of countless Syrians taking to the streets in a show of support and to celebrate his victory. They lie, they deny reality, and deceive to manufacture consent for regime change. That is what you call propaganda. Joining me is former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. Thank you for your time. It's great having you on the program, Your Excellency.
It's a pleasure.
Ambassador, the British government, along with the Americans and others, they called the elections in Syria, quote-unquote, undemocratic and illegitimate. They outright rejected the results before the elections even took place. Could you give us an insight into what the motivations behind this are?
In a word, revenge. The Western powers, Britain and America in particular, are bitter because they have failed in their 10-year-long campaign to change the government in Syria. and they are therefore very bitterly disappointed because the recent elections served to underline their failure and to cement the position of President Assad in power. So what we heard was the sound, if I can put it this way, the sound of sour grapes.
So having been posted in Damascus and spent several years there, what do you make of the legislative and the electoral process in Syria?
Well, I don't think there can be any doubt that a majority of the Syrian people do not share the West's wish to get rid of President Assad. On the contrary, the president is seen by indisputably by a majority of Syrians as representative of stability. They do not, the Syrian people, without a shadow of a doubt, do not want to make a leap into the dark by getting rid of the president that they know. And when there is no alternative in prospect who could unite the country, take the country forward in the next step, rather the reverse. I'm quite sure that a majority, an authentic majority of the Syrian people have confidence in their president. They may grumble about the conduct of the government, rising prices, corruption, alleged maladministration, that sort of thing. Which country is free from such grumbling? Certainly not my own, the UK. And indeed, I believe that the level of support for the president is authentically well above the estimated 40% level of support enjoyed in the opinion polls by Boris Johnson and his government. I believe that the Conservatives or Labour would be absolutely over the moon to have the level of support that President Assad has.
When you say that Syrians don't want to take a leap into what is essentially the unknown, what do you think the alternative is? What is the alternative that the West is proposing to President Assad?
The West is always careful not to spell out, any alternative, because they know full well that the only realistic alternative would be a radical Islamist regime. They are totally irresponsible in wishing for what they call euphemistically a transition, which is translated means a regime change. But that phrase has had a lot of bad publicity, so they call it transition. They don't ever say transition to what. And there is no Nelson Mandela waiting in the wings in Syria. In fact, most Syrian people could not put a name on any Syrian opposition leader. I would be hard-pressed myself. And I'm a so-called expert. There are no plausible rivals, alternative political leaders to the president. There are warlords. There are warlords who, like such as those who rule the roost in Idlib province, who would undoubtedly, after fighting among themselves, inherit the crown in Damascus if the Western powers had their way.
In the early days of Tony Blair's government, the United Kingdom and other countries, they actually seemed to be or appeared to be on good terms with President al-Assad. I mean, what do you make of the current stance of the last 10 years from those in British politics and media who insist that Syrians are not deciding their own future and who've done this complete 180?
A lot of things have happened since those heady days in the early 2000s when Bashar al-Assad was having tea with Her Majesty the Queen in Buckingham Palace and was being seen as the new white hope. and who was moving forward with liberalization of the economy in a way that was applauded in the West. And indeed, it was partly those efforts at liberalization by causing some suffering for the working classes in Syria and privileging of the middle class with this so-called liberalization. This was one of the reasons for the discontent which precipitated the uprising. But things have obviously moved on, and what Britain in particular cannot stomach is the fact that Syria has worked more and more closely with Russia and Iran, and therefore victory for Syria, victory for President Assad would be seen as victory for the leadership of Russia and Iran. This is something that the British government cannot stomach. So you have to see relations with Syria in the context of British relations with Russia and Iran. Poor old Syria is just the victim in the middle.
So just to wrap up, just as a last question, Ambassador, what do you think that al-Assad will do during his next term? What will be the next moves, do you think, from all these various governments that are trying to remove him and topple him? How do you see the rest of the war playing out?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the options the president must be looking at is whether to make a move on Idlib, now that his hands are less tied than they were, although this is a difficult moment internationally in one way because of the ongoing negotiations between the United States and Iran over nuclear and sanctions, and I can see some argument for not rocking the boat in Syria before that matter is settled. But in due course, I'm quite convinced that the Syrian government will move to repacify the north, the east. I can see increasing pressure on the U.S. Presence in northeast Syria. The tribes of that area, the Arab tribes of that area, are mostly very pro Assad. They will not tolerate the Kurdish suzerainty, which the American forces are imposing on them. But above all, I think the president will have his work cut out to cope with this continuing economic warfare. There is no doubt that it's the Western sanctions which are the biggest obstacle to Syrian reconstruction, and not just reconstruction, but even getting back a normal, ordinary life with the availability of fuel and bread. I'm sure that will be the president's number one priority.
Ambassador Peter Ford, thank you so much for your time, Your Excellency. I'm very grateful for you coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
The countries that have rejected the election results in Syria, dubbing the elections undemocratic, they have been trying to push an agenda and topple the Syrian government now for over 10 years. They have no genuine interest in the will of the Syrian people. They are most concerned with enacting their foreign policy objectives, in ensuring profits for their multinational corporations, and in expanding their empires. This notion of calling foreign leaders illegitimate or calling elections undemocratic is a tactic often used by the West when talking about countries that they have an imperialist agenda in. We have seen the United States, Britain, and the European Union do the same thing with the Venezuela's presidential elections and its parliamentary elections, which we covered in late 2020 on this program. We have seen the West do the exact same to Evo Morales in Bolivia in late 2019 when he was overthrown by right-wing groups supported by the West. And in the case of Venezuela, this notion of legitimacy has also been used by the Bank of England as a ruse to steal over $1 billion in gold belonging to the Venezuelan people. The West loves to pretend that it has the moral high ground. They speak about Syria, Venezuela, and others as if they are colonies under their rule. This is a colonial mindset. Who are these countries to talk about rejecting the results of the Syrian elections? The results of the Syrian elections are for the Syrian people to decide, and Syrians only, not some men in Whitehall, Washington, D.C., or Paris. I find it incredible that the United States has the gall to lecture other countries about democracy when its own citizens are disenfranchised from voting. African Americans are still treated like second-class citizens, and Native Americans completely removed from any political capacity, wiped out through centuries of genocide. How can the United Kingdom lecture anyone about democracy when its judiciary is controlled by the United States, when it gives immunity to American spies who kill British citizens, or when Julian Assange is rotting away in Belmarsh prison for exposing the war crimes of the U.S. empire? Where is the respect for an independent press and fourth estate? The United States and Britain together have colonized and plundered the world for centuries. To this day, they continue to overthrow the democratically elected governments of Latin America, Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. They are the last people on earth to be giving lectures about democracy. The fact of the matter is, there has been a cold, calculated attempt to overthrow the Syrian government for decades. We know from General Wesley Clark that a neocon plan for regime change has been put in place during the Bush years, with Syria on the list of targets. We have seen the cables from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus already in 2006 about how best to exploit the weaknesses of Bashar al-Assad in order to destabilize Syria. The United States created al-Qaeda during the Cold War, then with Britain proceeded to help create ISIS through the invasion of Iraq in 2003. With their allies, such as Israel and Turkey, they have provided weapons, logistics, and assistance to terrorist groups inside Syria. And then the media tries to whitewash them as moderate rebels. Since the start of the so-called Arab Spring or uprising in 2011, they have been trying to topple the Syrian government and turn the whole country into another failed puppet state, as they have done to so many others. Through their imperialist greed, they have completely, utterly destroyed Syria. These actors do not have Syria's best interests at heart, nor do they care about the will of the Syrian people. Quite the opposite. What Syrians have done through these elections is reaffirm their sovereignty, cementing their stance against imperialism and against colonialism. The election results are not just a victory for President Assad, they are a victory for the Syrian people. Syrians have shown their resolve and their spirit to be unbreakable. Even after 10 years of war and all the suffering that has come with it, they have been unrelenting. Once again, they are showing the world that they will not allow others to dictate their political, economic, and social affairs. Syrians will not allow foreign-backed terrorists and militias, nor any other governments, to come in and tell them how to run their country. Syrians want a secular, stable Syria under Bashar al-Assad, which stands with the axis of resistance, which stands with Palestinians, which stands against imperialism, and guarantees a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, harmonious, and peaceful society for all Syrians. No matter what the media says, no matter how much propaganda they produce, and how much they try to sell regime change, Syrians are saying they will not be coerced or bullied into conforming to Western foreign policy objectives. Syrian matters are for Syrians only to decide. If President Bashar al-Assad did not have the support of the Syrian people, he could never have remained in power and withstood 10 years of war against him, and withstood 10 years of the United States, Britain, and Israel, and so many other countries and their terrorist groups trying to get rid of him. No one could. It's unconscionable to think that anyone could survive such a feat without the backing of their own people. Syrians have shown that they support their president and their government, both during wartime and in their elections. For anyone to deny this is simply to deny reality. It's not about one's opinion or what one thinks. This is about understanding the truth on the ground. We also have to look at this election through the lens of resistance. What Syrians do every day, what they have done for years, is resist imperialism through all means necessary. This huge turnout and landslide victory also symbolizes a victory for the axis of resistance as a whole. When we talk about the axis of resistance, we're talking about the nations that the West has tried to break and intimidate, such as Syria, Iran, Palestine, Venezuela, Cuba, Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, North Korea. We have seen during this vicious war against Syria how the whole world rallied behind the U.S. empire and joined them in their regime change project. Very few stood by Syria's side and remained with the Syrian people. Iran and Russia have helped Syria to stay afloat and to resist this onslaught. When Syria was in its darkest hour and on the verge of falling into the hands of Daesh, they answered the call to aid. They stepped in to provide and help to prevent the unthinkable from happening. They have stood steadfast with the Syrian people, respecting their will and protecting their sovereignty from foreign aggression, both militarily and politically. The entire apparatus of the mainstream media continues to repeat the same lies about Syria in a multitude of languages and mediums. There is complete uniformity and hegemony between the corporate media and the foreign policy objectives of Western governments. Inextricably intertwined, these two institutions work in tandem, and everything they have reported on Syria for the last 10 years has been almost entirely propaganda. And the presidential elections of 2021 are no different. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight. A Baltimore factory that rendered useless 75 million doses of a coronavirus vaccine developed by Johnson & Johnson failed for weeks to seal off a preparation area for vaccine ingredients and allowed production waste to be hauled through the area, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said in a memorandum analyzing the plant's operations. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Sharon Lafreniere. The piece is titled, FDA Details Failures at a Baltimore Plant That Led to Unusable Vaccine Doses. A Baltimore factory that rendered useless 75 million doses of a coronavirus vaccine developed by Johnson & Johnson failed for weeks to seal off a preparation area for vaccine ingredients and allowed production waste to be hauled through the area, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said in a memorandum analyzing the plant's operations. The memorandum, posted on the agency's website late on Friday, 11th of June, offered the most extensive explanation to date of why regulators believe that tens of millions of doses of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine produced at that factory in Baltimore must be discarded. The FDA advised Johnson & Johnson on Friday that it should throw out the equivalent of 60 million doses of the vaccine. That brought to 75 million the total number of doses that cannot be used because of concerns about contamination at a southeastern Baltimore plant operated by Emergent BioSolutions, Johnson & Johnson's subcontractor and a longtime government contractor. The vaccine-making factory has been shut for the past 2 months, while regulators determined the cause of the contamination that ruined many doses, whether it is safe to reopen the facility, and what to do with the equivalent of at least 170 million doses of the vaccine that Emergent produced for Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, another vaccine developer. The Food and Drug Administration's FDA's memo stated that Emergent failed to properly segregate zones in which workers manufactured vaccines developed by Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca in order to prevent cross-contamination that could render doses unsafe or ineffective. It was written by Dr. Peter Marks, the FDA's top vaccine regulator, and was addressed to Johnson & Johnson. When Emergent first began producing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in November of last year, the memo stated the plant's workers weighed and readied ingredients used to produce the two vaccines in separate areas. But once the factory began full production in December, workers began weighing and clearing materials for both vaccines in a common warehouse. At the same time, the accelerated pace of production created more waste. Emergent allowed workers to tote it through the warehouse in wheeled containers, according to the FDA's report and interviews with former Emergent workers familiar with the plant's procedures. That mistake is most likely to blame for Emergent's discovery in March that a batch of Johnson & Johnson vaccine had been contaminated with a key ingredient used to manufacture the AstraZeneca vaccine, the